Seated. Good afternoon. This is Ellis Lewis Mashburn Jr. versus the Alabama Department of Corrections. The commissioner, James Hubbard, is here for the appellant Mashburn. Bethany Lee is here for the commissioner. Mr. Hubbard, you may make your argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is James Hubbard, and I, along with Randy Suskin, represent Ellis Mashburn. This is a case about a death row prisoner who has repeatedly failed and denied fair process. He was failed first by trial counsel, whom the courts agreed performed efficiently when they advised Mr. Mashburn to plead guilty to capital murder with no deal in place, despite their inadequate mitigation, investigation, and preparation. He was then failed by a state post-conviction court who signed the state's proposed dismissal order 2 days after it was filed without granting discovery and without granting an evidentiary hearing. That court didn't provide notice to the parties, so the deadline to appeal passed. Mr. Mashburn was out of court effectively and had no idea. After an out-of-time appeal, the state appellate court unreasonably applied Strickland in affirming the dismissal of his Rule 32 petition.
I don't see anything in his amended petition where he says the state court's adjudication was unreasonable. That's why it was dismissed, wasn't it? He didn't say anything about the state court's, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals adjudication was unreasonable. And that's why it was, dismissed and the district court said it was abandoned. How do you answer that?
Yes, Your Honor. The district court initially found that portions of his ineffectiveness claim were abandoned. The district court understood Mr. Mashburn to presenting a relatively straightforward Strickland claim that the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals had unreasonably applied Strickland.
But his habeas petition looks like an exact duplicate, word for word, of his state Rule 32 petition, listing the exact same claims, facts, and arguments that were presented to the state court. But he doesn't state in his petition for writ of habeas corpus how the state court's adjudication was unreasonable. Why isn't that fatal for you?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Mashburn, we believe, presented, he explained that counsel were deficient because they had done no investigation for 2 years in this case. They had waited until the 11th hour to hire help and experts. They did not equip those people.
Well, you're going beyond the certificate of appealability now, aren't you?
Well, no, Your Honor. Mr. Mashburn's claim was that because of that deficient investigation, the resulting prejudice was that the jury did not hear about Mr. Mashburn's state of mind at the time of the offense and didn't hear about his untreated bipolar disorder.
We granted a certificate of appealability on three issues. The first is whether counsel was ineffective in the penalty phase by failing to present evidence regarding his state of mind at the time of the crimes. And the second is whether counsel was ineffective by failing to present evidence regarding his bipolar diagnosis, and the third, whether he was entitled to an evidentiary hearing in the district court. The mitigation investigation, that wasn't a part of the certificate of appealability, was it?
Well, I believe that is what established the deficient performance, and our position was that, and the way that Mr. Mashburn explained this claim was that the prejudice was that the jury never learned about his state of mind at the time of the offense and never learned about his bipolar disorder.
Well, let me. There was, I know you think it was inadequate, but there was evidence in the normal sense of the word at the sentencing hearing about his bipolar problem, right? Your contention is, as I understand it, is that the lawyer didn't develop that testimony enough, left it sort of hanging and vague, And then all the attorney was able to do at closing was refer to the fact that he had bipolar spectrum. But there was evidence of his bipolar problems. It's just that you think it wasn't developed enough, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor. So in a quarter page of transcript, counsel elicits testimony that Mr. Mashburn has bipolar disorder and some related behavioral disturbance. And there's no further testimony about what bipolar disorder is, what that behavioral disturbance is.
Right. No, I know you're, it seems to me your argument is that that theme was not developed enough. There weren't enough supporting facts. There wasn't an application of the disorder to what happened, et cetera. So I think I understand that part of the evidentiary puzzle. Now let me turn to the other part, which is his state of mind at the time. You provide a string cite in your brief, which I haven't been able to go back to yet, about where the testimony about his use of methamphetamines and his inability to sleep for 4 or 5 days was from. Where does that come from in the record, if you could help me?
Of course, Your Honor. So that is in his habeas petition, section 3D1. That covers a good chunk of the...
But not where it's alleged. I want, where is the evidence of that? Evidence in the record that he was under the influence of methamphetamines and that he had been unable to sleep for 4 or 5 days at the time of the murders.
Just so that I'm clear, Your Honor, you're asking about, as alleged in the petition, what pieces of evidence are you asking in the trial record?
It doesn't matter where you're getting it from. I want to know where in the record.
Okay.
Normally the way, I know that every case is different, but in most capital cases where the claim is that the defense counsel failed to put on certain mitigating evidence, the state post-conviction record contains that evidence. Like, you should have hired this expert who would have testified about X. You should have put on this witness who would have testified about the defendant's childhood. You should have put on this witness who would have said this, who would have said that. So where in the record am I going to find evidence of his use of methamphetamines and his lack of sleep at the time of the murders?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize. I understand your question now. So Mr. Mashburn pleaded in his petition several witnesses who were childhood friends, parents of his childhood friends, ex-girlfriends, pastors. In addition, part of his claim was that counsel, because of their lack of investigation and preparation, they did not elicit testimony from their experts. They didn't prepare their experts. So part of our testimony, the claim is not that the experts were ineffective, but counsel was ineffective for failing to elicit that testimony.
I know. Where's that testimony going to come from? Who was going to testify that he was under the influence of methamphetamine at the time of the murders?
So the mitigation expert had some of that information. The experts had some of that information. These additional witnesses also had some related information. And Mr. Mashburn pleaded in his petition that that information would have established that.
Go ahead.
Your argument is that counsel was ineffective by failing to present this testimony during the penalty phase of his trial, that he hadn't slept for 5 days, he was under the, he was taking prescription drugs, and that he was under the influence of methamphetamine, that none of that was presented during the trial, right? But the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals dismissed that claim because it was conclusory, right? It was conclusory. So how did the court, and the court relied on Tharp versus Humphrey and found that the claims are abandoned because the allegations are conclusory. Why aren't those claims abandoned?
Well, Your Honor,
You don't even talk about abandoned in your brief. You go on to the merits because the court made an alternative ruling. It reached the merits, but it all... alternatively, but it also found that those claims were abandoned. Can you tell us why those claims were not abandoned?
In the federal district court, Your Honor.
In the federal district court.
We believe that that issue was resolved when the district court responded to our Rule 59e motion. The district court's ruling about abandonment, I don't think it's sort of a classical abandonment argument. It found that 45 pages of Mr. Mashburn's petition had been abandoned. And it's not. This is not a case where, for example, the district court made a time bar ruling and separately, just to be cautious, made a merits ruling. Two very independent inquiries. It appears that the district court was unpersuaded by Mr. Mashburn's claims. I get that. And in the Rule 59e motion, we pointed out
The court said that the claim that his petition was conclusory. It was conclusory. It wasn't specific enough.
Why is that
erroneous?
Your Honor, that's erroneous because we pointed out to the district court that Mr. Mashburn had pleaded that that counsel should have put on evidence that he was high at the time of the offense of methamphetamines, psychotropic drugs, and that he was experiencing untreated bipolar disorder. Two of the most, powerful mitigating circumstances that I think counsel can put on, especially in a case like this, that calls out for explanation. This was a family offense. Mr. Mashburn loved his grandmother.
None of that was in his petition, though. None of that was in his petition, which gets back to what Judge Jordan was asking. You didn't identify any expert who might have testified as to the effect of having not slept for 5 days and being on prescription drugs and being on methamphetamine. You didn't expand on that at all in your petition, which is why the court found that it was conclusory and dismissed it as insufficient. So I guess my question is, why haven't you abandoned that issue because the petition was insufficient?
I think our position is that Mr. Mashburn did explain that this evidence is evidence that counsel had access to and that they knew or should have known because of their mitigation expert, even due to what limited investigation that she did. But counsel was so unfamiliar with that mitigation work that they could not at trial elicit testimony that would have changed how the jury viewed Mr. Mashburn, that would have helped the jury to understand that Mr. Mashburn's brain chemistry was so disrupted that he couldn't recognize who he loved and who loved him.
So if we look at your petition, we'll see allegations about what his state of mind was at the time of the crime, what evidence could have been presented, and how it would be mitigating?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, Mr. Mashburn pleaded that, for example, the drugs, the methamphetamines, the psychotropic drugs that he was on, mm-hmm. would have caused him to be more impulsive, less inhibited, generally impaired judgment, and unable to regulate his emotions. He would have been unable to prevent himself from acting on emotions that he could not control.
Who would have testified to that?
I think the mitigation expert could have testified that if trial counsel had known or had taken the time to understand what was available to him, they could have elicited that testimony from the mitigation expert, from Dr. Schaefer, from Dr. Sachi even.
So you don't, as the record stands now, there is no person, lay or expert, who will testify to the effect of the drugs on him?
Well, I think those individuals, when the additional family members, the childhood friends,
about the effect of drugs,
you need an expert. That's correct, right? But I think those expert and that mitigation witness could have talked about that.
But there's maybe it's just a disconnect. So I apologize on my end, but. If the claim is that defense counsel didn't present X and should have presented X, a state post-conviction petition will normally contain evidence of X and say had you called this expert, had you really talked to your mitigation expert, here's what they would have presented. Here's an affidavit from the witness who would have testified had she been contacted, had she been retained, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see any of that in your federal habeas petition. You say, in a lot of places, trial counsel didn't present evidence of X, but there's no indication of where X comes from and who's going to be able to testify about it. So, for example, who's going to testify that he had been unable to sleep for 4 or 5 days? Where was that evidence going to come from?
You're right. I think that evidence could have come from some of the family witnesses. I think they could have come from, for example, the friends that he had in his world, some of the, for example, one of the ex-girlfriends who was very involved in his life and with his family.
But you didn't have affidavits from them saying, had I been called, I would have testified that he had been unable to sleep for 4 or 5 days before the murders?
No, Your Honor. In the state post-conviction court, Mr. Mashburn filed his Rule 32 petition. That was dismissed without discovery, without an evidentiary hearing. Otherwise, he has not had an opportunity to develop the facts that we believe would, again, change how the jury would have understood Mr. Mashburn.
How would discovery have helped you if it's your burden to come forward with at least something to show that the lawyers missed certain critical evidence that should have been put before the jury?
I apologize. My point was to say that I don't think that there's been much process for Mr. Mashburn. I think that again, part of his allegations are that counsel, as they admitted, were not prepared. And as the district court said, there's a total lack of tactical deliberation. And so
all the more reason why it doesn't seem too difficult a task to explain who else could have provided the evidence that these lawyers missed. Like, we've had Mr. Mashburn examined. He had bipolar disorder. Dr. X will testify that this bipolar disorder prevented him from understanding fully the consequences of his action or made him act impulsively. These family members will testify that in the 2 or 3 or 4 days leading up to the murders, he had been unable to sleep, he was incoherent, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't see any of that in either the state petition or even a description in the federal petition. And I think that's a problem.
Your Honor, and we weren't counsel below, and I understand that Mr. Mashburn's petition.
I don't mean to blame you. By saying you, I mean Mr. Mashburn and
right.
His counsel back then. So
I just say that to say that I think, his petition, we believe, contains all the facts establishing that he was prejudiced by counsel's deficient performance, and I understand that it's not a perfect petition. But I think especially in a bipolar disorder, for example, when counsel, and this comes at the tail end of Dr. Sacci's testimony, counsel asks this question, Dr. Sacci says, bipolar disorder and behavioral disturbance. That goes nowhere. Counsel does nothing with that. And that's part of Mr. Mashburn's argument, is that counsel just had to ask one or two more questions to say, what is bipolar disorder? What does that mean for Mr. Mashburn? How does that impact
and
him?
Is there anything from that doctor in the record about what he would have said had he been asked the additional questions?
Or
is that just supposition on Mr. Mashburn's part?
I don't think it's supposition, but Mr. Mashburn does explain that would have, along with the substance abuse, performed a feedback loop that would have ratcheted up this impulsivity, this lack of inhibition, and this emotional dysregulation, this sort of state that he was in where, again, his brain chemistry just could not allow him to understand what was going on, who he was harming.
But the problem is, what you're saying makes perfect sense as far as what the conclusion might have ultimately been. I'm sure we've all heard testimony in different cases or seen testimony in different cases where something like that was said. But it's your client's burden to prove the case, and we don't have any evidence in the record that we can rely on. We can't, you know, we can't say, well, we've read about this before in other cases, and other expert witnesses have testified to it. That's what the problem is. So, like, at least for me, I'd like to hear, I want to make sure I give you an opportunity to tell me if I'm missing something, where in the record we could draw that from.
Yes, Your Honor. So, again, part of Mr. Mashburn's claim is that counsel did not understand what they had. They had the material before them. They did introduce some evidence of his drug use in a very aggravating way, but they didn't introduce the start of that drug use, which they had. They did not introduce the tragic endpoint of that drug use, which was him taking methamphetamines and psychotropic drugs. Again, counsel had that in their world of mitigation because that's the mitigation expert had some of that. The experts had some of that. They all had were working from the same sort of social history that this mitigation expert had developed.
Maybe I could ask it more pointedly. Is there any evidence in the record that goes to sort of the $6 million question, right, which is, okay, because he was taking methamphetamine and had been up for 5 days, was bipolar, he, you know, didn't know what he was doing. He, you know, some kind of diagnosis from some expert in the field. Is there anything like that? And if there isn't, why isn't that a problem for you since you have the burden here?
Well, I think so. Again, some of that would have come from the experts. So Dr. Satcher on the bipolar disorder, for example. But again, taking a step back, he filed his Rule 32 petition. This is counsel who pleaded him guilty with no deal in place. He is asking for an opportunity to develop this evidence. And again, I recognize that it's not a perfect petition, but we believe that he has pleaded this evidence that would establish that the sentencing determination, the death penalty, is unreliable. And I believe my time is about to be up, and I'm happy to continue to respond to questions in rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. We'll hear from Ms. Lee on behalf of the commissioner.
May it please the court, Bethany Lee for the state. I'd like to start first by addressing the line of questioning from Judge Jordan and Judge Rosenbaum, which I think is really crucial here. The appellant has never alleged where this evidence exists of the state of mind that they are now alleging. I'm hearing for the first time some articulation of where this evidence could reside. I take it that appellant is now saying that the mitigation specialist knew that the appellant was under the influence of methamphetamine at the time of the crime, and that trial counsel just didn't bother to ask her, and thus it didn't get presented to the jury. You'll notice that allegation was never made in any of the briefs in the habeas petition, and here's why it was never made. Because it's false. Because the trial counsel did ask the mitigation specialist on the stand multiple times if she knew if... Yes,
now,
Judge Wilson.
This is pretty powerful evidence that could have been presented during the penalty phase of his trial.
Yes.
This guy he's pled guilty to killing his grandparents. And there was no evidence presented none at all, that he hadn't slept for 5 days, he was on meth and prescription drugs, none at all?
No, Judge Wilson, there was evidence. So I like to read some excerpts from the trial transcript. This is a nearly 1,000-page trial transcript, just the penalty phase, because it lasted 5 days, and there was an immense amount of mitigating evidence put forward. Of the 1,000 pages, over 700 were mitigating evidence. And trial counsel repeatedly asked about methamphetamine use, and he elicited testimony multiple times that the appellant was always using methamphetamine, that from the age of 21 till the day of his arrest, he was constantly using methamphetamine, that he would not ever stop using methamphetamine, and that he had problems sleeping ever since he started using methamphetamine, that he was constantly sleep deprived. Trial counsel...
This came in through what witness?
the mitigation specialist, who Ms. Wardell, who had spent 4 months investigating. Yes.
And the mitigation specialist testified that at the time of the crime?
So I can read the quotes. Trial counsel tried to elicit testimony that he was specifically on the very moment of the crime under an influence. And so here's the quote, and this is from page 1686 of the trial court record, the transcript. The trial counsel asks, was he still using marijuana when he was arrested? Answer, yes. Question, was he still using pills, Xanax, Klonopin when he was arrested? Answer, yes. Question, was he still using methamphetamine? Answer, I presume, based on the history. Question, but was that information ever specifically given to you at that time? Answer, no. Then a little down the page, he says, did he ever stop using methamphetamine? Answer, no. On another page, on page 1682 of the transcript, yes, Your Honor.
But that's not why the district court dismissed this petition. The district court dismissed this petition because it was conclusory.
Yes, Your Honor.
And not specific enough.
Yes, Your Honor, which is absolutely correct. It was conclusory. There was no allegation that of some evidence that somebody had that could have changed the result.
Well, what else did he need to say? I mean, he says that counsel failed, whether it was true or not, failed to present evidence that he was high on methamphetamine and without sleep for 4 to 5 days at the time of the crime, and this is likely to have an effect on one's behavior and mental state, close quote.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so what else does he need to say in order to have a sufficient petition?
Well, as the
he's got to name the expert who would testify to that?
So yes, as Judge Jordan and Judge Rosenbaum's questions have been implying, there does need to be an allegation, as there has been in all of the other successful ineffectiveness cases, that, you know, I have a sister who knew that I hadn't slept for 5 days and she was willing to testify, but nobody ever asked her. Or the doctor specifically said I should get another test for a bipolar diagnosis and nobody ever followed up on his recommendation. There is nothing like that here. So even if we accept all of his factual allegations to be true, that is still not enough to state a claim for ineffectiveness. And I will add, of course, that this case is not in federal court de novo. There is the very deferential AEDPA standard that applies. And
not on the abandonment issue.
Abandonment issue, but on the prejudice holding. And as this court en banc has said in Pai, the federal court should be supplementing justifications for the prejudice holding that the state court has made, even if the state court didn't put out all the different reasons that the claim fails on the merits.
See, I'm not sure that. I think you need evidence of evidence that wasn't presented to win. But in terms of pleading, I'm not sure. Like, had he said, if he had said, Ms. Lee, I have witnesses who will testify that I was on methamphetamines during the murder, at the time of the murder, and that I had been unable to sleep for 5 days. If he said that, is that enough? And those witnesses were not called by trial counsel. They were available but not called. Is that enough?
That would be enough to not abandon the claim, but it would still not be enough to meet the prejudice, to overcome the state court's prejudice holding. Because even if you accept...
But to overcome it as a matter of pleading or as a matter of proof?
A matter of proof. So as
not a pleading issue, then.
It's not an abandonment issue, if that's what you're asking.
But it's not really abandonment. Abandonment is when you say, I'm going to raise claim X, and then you don't raise claim X.
Sure, Your Honor.
This is... Essentially, you have not sufficiently pled the claim.
Yes. So
it's not an abandonment issue. It's almost like a heightened pleading 12B6. There's not enough here. But it's not abandonment per se.
Sure. So just to be clear, I do think that would still fail in the sort of 12B6 world, because even if you accept those alleged facts to be true, that there was someone who would have testified to his sleep deprivation, that still could not create a substantial likelihood that the jury would reach another result, both because there was already evidence.
But that's only one step in the analysis. You first have to explain what the lawyer didn't present, Then you have to explain that that evidence is available right now and
yes.
somebody would testify to it. And then third, you have to explain why that new evidence that wasn't presented would change the outcome, for lack of a better term, right? But they don't have to be made together, those three things.
So if they pled the first two and we accept them, we accept those allegations to be true, then we ask, under all of those accepted facts, would it meet the prejudice standard? If it doesn't, then there is no point in allowing an evidentiary hearing to go and prove those sets of facts that
right,
they have
that's
alleged.
That's not abandonment. That's just insufficiency.
Sure.
Right?
Sure, yes.
The state argue abandonment below?
I believe the district court held it, and
district court did it. I want to know if the state argued it.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I actually don't recall exactly what we argued in the district court. Of course, if the district court holds it and it's an independent grounds for dismissal, then an appellant who wishes to challenge the decision of the state court must challenge each independent grounds for dismissal.
I get all of that, but I'm not sure that abandonment is quite right. And I wonder if the district court came upon that verbiage on its own or whether it was led into using it by someone.
So the district court cited a number of cases. One of them was Flanagan's Enterprises in this court, which stated that a claim without elaboration or citation of authority in support waives that allegation. So sometimes this court uses the word waive, sometimes it uses the word abandon. In Sapupo.
Right, but those are appellate cases where someone says something in a brief and then you read the brief and there's nothing to support it. Those aren't pleading cases.
Yes, Your Honor. So, fair enough. That said, even if you disagree with the district court's abandonment holding, there's still the second level of abandonment, which is that the appellants never challenged the abandonment holding in this court. This court in Sapupo was very clear, and it wasn't stating a new...
So he abandoned the abandonment argument.
Exactly. In Sapupo, this court said, if a district court has multiple independent grounds for dismissing a claim, and the appellant doesn't challenge all of those independent grounds for dismissal, then the claim automatically fails.
So when the court says you abandon these claims, what the court was really saying was that your petition was not specific enough. It's too conclusory. Is that?
That was my reading, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And so I
guess that's what I'm really having a problem with. For example, with regard to the bipolar diagnosis, he didn't make claims about the effects of the disorder on him personally, but he did say, and I'm quoting, it causes impulsivity and episodic extreme discontrol, which can lead to unpredictable, involuntary, combative behavior, close quote. And he also identifies the doctor who gave the bipolar diagnosis and who presumably could have provided more details about the consequences of the diagnosis. So why isn't that enough to make his petition specific? That seems pretty specific to me.
I believe the district court was pointing out that there were no citations to the factual record and no citations to legal authority, which this court has suggested in appellate cases that are insufficient. And the district court also cited lower court cases, and I realize those aren't binding, but lower court cases applying a similar standard where a claim is waived when there are no citations and not fully elaborated on. If I could follow up on that particular point about the effects of bipolar disorder, I would also say that that fails to, even if we accept all of those alleged facts to be true, it still fails to cause any prejudice in this case because there was evidence presented in the trial court in the penalty phase. So if I could read just page 2211 to 12 of the trial transcript, the expert is opining about brain damage from all the experiences that the appellant has had, and he says it causes discontrol, rage episodes, impulse problems, and so forth. And then on page 2357, Dr. Saichi is specifically testifying about bipolar disorder and the corresponding brain damage, and he says it can lead to behavioral disturbance, including aggression. So there really isn't a whole lot more that is being alleged that could have been added. I think, Judge Jordan, you were quite on point when you said the appellant is not really alleging that bipolar disorder evidence wasn't presented. They just wish it were presented a little better. And I think that's kind of a theme.
So the failure to provide the name of an expert in your petition translates to a failure to plead a Strickland claim?
Because it still would not meet, it would still not be enough to establish prejudice given the vast amount of mitigating evidence, including mitigating evidence specifically about his brain damage, his bipolar disorder, and his substance use, including substance use around the time of his crime, including the brain damage that would have been during the time of the crime, including the sleep deprivation. Given that all of that was already presented to the jury during the penalty, during this 5-day comprehensive penalty phase of the trial, it cannot be that a few extra words somehow would have just driven home the point a little better with the jury. And of course, the decision to give the death penalty wasn't just a function of the mitigating evidence. There was very comprehensive mitigating evidence presented about all phases of the appellant's life, from his difficult childhood and the abuse he suffered and the untreated psychiatric illness and the substance abuse that started at a very young age till adulthood. But it was also because a jury in Calhoun County, Alabama, heard that a grown man was invited into the home of his own elderly grandmother and step-grandfather and used a knife together with his accomplice to slaughter them and leave them disfigured, dying in pools of their own blood. They were so disfigured that when the grandmother's sister came into the home, she couldn't tell who was the wife and who was the husband.
And you think that's normal behavior?
No, and the jury knew that as well. And the jury knew.
But that's the whole point, right? The point is that if he was on meth and other drugs and hadn't slept in 5 days and had bipolar disorder, that's what was causing this, because normal people don't do this.
Yes.
And so I mean, he would say that shows that there was prejudice, right?
So it shows that there is not prejudice because the jury knew all of those things. They knew about his bipolar disorder and the effects that can have on behavior. They knew about his extensive substance abuse, including his constant use of methamphetamine and the effect that can have on the brain and behavior. They knew about the sleep deprivation, that he was getting on average 2 hours of sleep per night, meaning he's extremely sleep deprived. They knew about the brain damage. They heard from experts, and they knew about the utter craziness of this crime. So, of course, the same way that you and I are making these connections in their heads, so were these reasonable jurors. It cannot be that a few extra words about these issues would have changed their mind. They knew about these things, and they knew about the heinous, cruel, atrocious details of the crime, and they came to the conclusion that the death penalty was appropriate. The gist of appellant's argument really is that trial counsel just wasn't a good enough storyteller, that if he just tied things together more clearly, if he had been more compelling, more charismatic, maybe the jury would have been more compelled to change their mind. There is no Strickland case like this that comes out in favor of the defendant. All of the cases cited by appellant involve huge pieces of evidence that were not presented to the jury at all. For example, a defendant who was beaten, raped, and burnt as a child and forced to eat paint chips, and the jury heard nothing about it. Or a defendant who had severe psychiatric illness and borderline retardation, and the jury heard nothing about it. This case is the opposite. The jury heard all about his mental health issues, his substance abuse issues, his brain damage. They heard from experts about how that can affect behavior.
You may be right at the end of the day, but I think you're being too dismissive, because bipolar disorder doesn't manifest itself every day, right? You can be bipolar and you can be perfectly normal on day one, and you can have all sorts of problems on day two and day three. And so telling the jury, assuming the evidence was available and there, that he likely had a bipolar episode at the time of the murders would have certainly been significant. Telling them that he was on methamphetamine on the day of the murder and that he was sleep deprived on the day of the murder, you put all those three things together, you start getting an understanding of what might have happened and why this savage double murder might have taken place.
Yes, Your Honor. So given the fact that the jury knew that he was constantly on methamphetamine, and there are multiple pages in the trial transcript where the trial counsel was eliciting testimony about the defendant's constant methamphetamine use, including he specifically says the month of the crime. He says, I want you to take me up to this terrible killing that happened in October 2002, and I want you to take me up to early October. And I know I've asked this question before, but was Ellis still doing all the things we talked about, specifically the methamphetamine, the pills? Answer, yes. So the jury was repeatedly hearing about this. It cannot be that a reasonable jury was sitting there thinking, well, yes, the defendant is constantly using methamphetamine. He was definitely using methamphetamine during October 2002. But, you know, maybe this was the day that he decided to change his life around and go clean and then murder his grandparents. That makes no sense. Of course they knew he was using methamphetamine. And I will also add, of course, that under the highly deferential AEDPA standard, the state court decision on prejudice must be upheld unless its error is so great that it lies beyond any room for fair-minded disagreement. That can't be the case here. It was entirely fair for the state court to decide that this was not sufficient to create a substantial likelihood that the jury would change its mind.
Well, that may very well be true, but one of the concerns that I think we might have is that at no point did Mr. Mashburn ever have an evidentiary hearing, either in state court or in federal court. Is that right?
That's right, and that's why we're accepting all of their alleged facts to be true at this point. But even if you accept them all to be true, that is not enough to establish a substantial likelihood that the jury would change its mind, and certainly not under the deferential AEDPA standard.
You're not accepting the facts as true. You're challenging them every bit of the way.
And which facts are that, Your Honor?
All of them. He says the jury didn't hear about methamphetamine use. You just quoted evidence in the record that says they did. He says the jury didn't hear about the effects of bipolar disorder. You just quoted evidence that said they did. You're fighting them at every step of the way, Ms. Lee.
Your Honor, that's a good point. I would love to clear that up. So we accept all of their alleged facts as to what evidence exists out there that could now be presented if they had the opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. I don't think anybody can ethically allege a fact as to what was said in trial, given that we have a trial transcript. The transcript says exactly what was said in trial, so that cannot be disputed.
I'm not challenging you on that point. My point is you're not accepting what they're alleging.
Your Honor,
you may be right in not accepting it, but you're not accepting it.
So we only have to accept the alleged facts as to what they would prove at an evidentiary hearing. And obviously, they cannot prove what was said or not said at trial.
But you're only doing that by referring to something outside of the pleading. If you're doing a 12B6 analysis and you say you accept the allegations, you can't then say the allegation is insufficient because the real-world evidence is different. You can't do that. So you can't say I'm accepting the habeas petition and everything it alleges and then say it's insufficient because the record demonstrates otherwise.
Your Honor, I would take you back to the AEDPA standard, which says that...
Not the AEDPA standard. We're talking about the sufficiency of the pleading at the federal district court on habeas, which is not an AEDPA deference matter.
I think there are two issues here, Your Honor. One is the sufficiency
AEDPA deference, of the... AEDPA deference is whether or not, at the end of the day, a habeas court can say that a state court decision was so wrong that it's unreasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
AEDPA says nothing, you can correct me if I'm wrong, about the pleading standard on a federal district habeas claimant. And with regards to the standards for pleading a habeas claim, although they're stringent, those are federal standards. Those are not standards that are triggered in any way by AEDPA deference. If I'm mistaken, I'm happy to be corrected.
The state court decision was on the merits, and therefore, if the district court is going to reject the state court's merit determination that there was insufficient pleadings, then the state court must disagree with the state court's merits decision, which is an AEDPA standard.
But the district court wasn't ruling. When the district court said or ruled that certain claims were abandoned, It wasn't applying AEDPA deference. It was saying, as a matter of federal practice, you have insufficiently set out your claims on bipolar disease and on use of methamphetamines, et cetera. As a federal district court, you have insufficiently pled. I am deeming those abandoned. It was not performing AEDPA deference.
Yes, Your Honor. Remember, the district court made two alternative independent holdings. One was abandonment, and I'll agree, abandonment as to the pleadings, that's not an AEDPA thing. The second independent grounds for dismissal was on the merits. That is where AEDPA applies. And so now I'm saying, for that, you know, even if you disagree with the abandonment and say, you know, the pleading was just fine, then you have to get to the merits. And on the merits, you have to apply the AEDPA deferential standard. Yes, because it's a merits determination by the state court that you're reviewing.
I completely agree, but not on whether or not the habeas petition in and of itself was sufficiently pled.
Sure, and that goes to the first alternative holding of the district court as to abandonment. So setting that aside, even if you want to say the district court was wrong in that first abandonment holding, if you get to the second one, the merits, which you have to if you say the abandonment was wrong, on the merits, you have to apply AEDPA deference to the state court's merit determination that there was insufficient pleadings to establish Strickland prejudice. And in assessing that under AEDPA, you have to come up with any justification that could justify the state court's decision. And so in that case, you do need to look at the trial transcript to see what was said if the appellant's allegations are completely contradicting what is actually seen in the transcript. So I do want to clear up another thing that was stated in the appellant's briefings. They say a couple of times that both the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals and the District Court accepted that Mr. Mashburn pleaded facts in his Rule 32 petition establishing that trial counsel's performance was deficient. And then they cite the District Court opinion at 94, and they quote mid-sentence saying, the court accepts Mashburn's assertion are sufficient to establish counsel's deficient investigation. I do want to point out that if you look at the full sentence, it starts out with the words, for analysis purposes. And I think, as your honors well know, whenever you write a sentence that says, for analysis purposes, we accept X to be true, you're not actually accepting X to be true. So I want to clear that up. And also, the state court never accepted that he had sufficiently pled the first prong of Strickland either. You can read the entire state court opinion, and it's not there, and certainly not as to the state of mind issue that is actually before this court. As Judge Wilson has pointed out, the certificate of appealability was as to a narrow issue. I also want to point out that there was in no sense any constitutionally deficient performance here. Trial counsel hired an extremely well-qualified, well-experienced mitigation specialist who was not only someone who had been a capital mitigation specialist for years, she was also a public defender who had been representing capital defendants for years.
They certainly waited a long time to hire this mitigation expert.
There were some other...
One month before the trial?
This was 6 months before the trial. And again, this extremely experienced mitigation specialist, when she first got hired and started doing a preliminary investigation, she said she would need 4 months. And the trial court extended her trial date till she had 6 months. And appellant concedes that she was spending at least 4 of those months investigating. And her investigation was very thorough. She interviewed the appellant, she interviewed his immediate family members, she interviewed his relatives, she interviewed his friends, she interviewed his neighbors, she interviewed his teachers. She looked for medical records and school records. She went to his childhood home and took pictures of the walls where there were indentations of where he had hurt himself.
The brief says that the lawyers did not interview the mitigation witnesses before the trial. Is that accurate?
I don't have any record citation on that. However, There is no allegation that there was something she would have said differently if they had talked to her. Again, she was so experienced. She was not just a mitigation specialist. She was a public defender, so she knew exactly what to present. And as to state of mind, which is before this court today, as I've quoted, there are many instances throughout this nearly 1,000-page trial transcript where the trial counsel was asking all kinds of questions about state of mind, including methamphetamine use, all kinds of other substance abuse, sleep. There's evidence of sleep deprivation. There were expert testimony about brain damage, about bipolar disorder, et cetera. So appellant really isn't identifying anything in particular that could suffice to meet this high Strickland standard, either for deficiency or prejudice. And, you know, when you layer on top the highly deferential AEDPA standard, their claim really can't get anywhere.
So the mitigation specialist was hired, what do you say, 6 months before the trial?
Yes.
But the mental evaluations didn't take place until 1 month before the trial?
Yes.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah, so the mitigation specialist was actually the one who suggested bringing in the psychiatrist and the psychologist because she was seeing all of this evidence that was alerting her to, you know, there might be mental health issues here. And so she brought in two people who she knew were good at working on these kinds of cases. They examined him, they were presented with all of the evidence, and they testified, again, about the bipolar disorder and the effects that can have on someone's behavior, about the brain damage and the effects that can have on someone's behavior, about the effects of substance abuse on brain damage and behavior. So the jury heard all of this. And I understand that appellant wishes they had been more charismatic and just explained things a little better, but that is not the Strickland standard, and it's certainly not Strickland standard with AEDPA deference layered on top. If there are no further questions, I would just really recommend to you this trial transcript, which I think if you read it, you will be impressed by the competency of the trial counsel and the defense team and the huge breadth and width of mitigating evidence that was presented to the jury. And I ask this court to affirm.
All right, thank you, Ms. Lee. And Mr. Hubbard, you've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. So a few things, Your Honors. I just want to reiterate our position on the abandonment issue. It is that the court below, I believe, ruled in our favor on that. And that's why there's no need to appeal. He initiated his initial finding of abandonment was there, but we argued to that court in the Rule 59e motion that we did not abandon. We asked the court to address the merits, and it did in its order. And so our position is that that's resolved. And then circling back, first, just to be clear, there was no evidentiary hearing in state court. So there was no opportunity to actually put on evidence, to put records into the record. And generally, usually in Alabama, Rule 32 petition is filed. Oftentimes, there's an evidentiary hearing. And there was not one here.
You got to have a request, number one, and number two, you got to plead sufficient facts that would entitle you to evidentiary hearing. So we would first have to, in order for you to be entitled to an evidentiary hearing, we'd have to find that the allegations of the petition are sufficient. All right?
Yes, Your Honor. And first, to be clear, there's no allegation that he was not diligent in pursuing an evidentiary hearing. He repeatedly asked for one. And on that point about where in the record he alleged these deficient performance and prejudice, for example, in his Rule 32 petition, paragraph 222, he notes, I'm quoting, presentation at the sentencing phase not include information which was known to Mr. Mashburn's mitigation specialist, would have been known to her had they begun their investigation in a timely manner. Paragraph 223.
There's no specificity as to what that evidence was?
Well, in additional paragraphs, there's in 258, for example, the petition notes that children with bipolar disorder often hear auditory hallucinations, which is something that Mr. Mashburn experienced. That came in at a point in time at trial, but the reality is he had auditory hallucinations throughout his childhood, as Mr. Mashburn alleged in his petition. It's also at paragraph 190. At paragraph 170, as a result of their failure to understand the mitigating evidence collected by Susan Wardell during their investigation, they failed to present much of it at trial. And Your Honor brought up the string cites in our brief, and I don't have all of them reproduced before me, but we would say that he needed to allege the reason that he was prejudiced by counsel's deficient performance, and we believe that those facts are in his petition.
Why do you think, let's get to the ultimate merits, why do you think that had evidence of bipolar disorder been developed a little bit more and evidence of his, as you put it, state of mind the day of the murders, that this might have tipped the balance given the savagery of the murders?
Yes, Your Honor, a couple points on that. So first, I think it's not true that it's a little bit more or a little bit better. I think the picture that trial counsel presented was an aggravating picture. They presented Mr. Mashburn as a bad kid from a bad family who made bad decisions that had bad consequences.
I disagree. Not completely. That wasn't the way they pictured him completely. I read the trial counsel's closing argument again today, and he explained all of the difficult things that happened to him. The difficulties at school, the learning disabilities, the problems with this, the problem with that, and the fact that the parents and caretakers didn't do anything about it and just let it go. So I'm not sure that it was all a presentation of Mr. Mashburn being a quote-unquote bad kid. It was a presentation about bad things happening to a child, and then look at where we ended up. That's the sense I got from the closing argument.
I think that on that point, Your Honor, in a capital case, and especially one like this, as you noted, the state noted, the facts are really hard. And I think they were hard for Mr. Mashburn's family. I think they were hard for him. Our point is that the jury needed to hear that when all of this happened, he was in such a state that his brain was not processing things in the way that a normal person would be. All the guardrails, all the off-ramps are gone. He's in a car with a gas pedal to the floor, and a steering wheel that doesn't work. The jury needed to hear that, and I think that goes directly to both the aggravation and challenges the impact of that. And it also affects how the jury would view his moral culpability in this case and their sense of his intent and control in what was happening. And finally, Your Honor, just before I leave, I would like to reiterate that he just wants an opportunity.
And then with the time that you have left, address the state's argument that, well, the jury heard enough of that such that this case was decided on Strickland prejudice, that this additional evidence would not have made a difference.
Of course, I think my response to that is that, stepping back, what the jury heard was kind of a bit about the course of his life. They did not hear the start of this journey. They didn't hear that his only path in life was to self-medicate. They didn't hear that his mother and paternal grandmother drugged him with Robitussin when he was 6 years old, so much so that he became dependent. I think that changes how the jury views his substance abuse from there on. He was consistently self-medicating a number of problems, and they're addressed in our brief, and that knowledge of how to self-medicate, that was given to him by the adults in his life. The jury, I don't think, had that sense. And at the same time, they didn't know fully the tragic endpoint of that path. And they didn't know. They had some general knowledge about his drug use. They didn't have specific knowledge that he actually was high on methamphetamines and psychotropic drugs, that he had been awake. And those two things, I think, change completely the understanding of this case. And again, Mr. Mashburn, we'd just like one opportunity, one time, to put that evidence before a court.
All right, I think we have your argument. Thank you,
Thank you,
counsel.
Your Honors.
Thank you. Court is adjourned.